This episode is sponsored by Interactive Brokers. And are you struggling to manage your finances across multiple banks and brokers and credit cards and retirement plans? Well, Portfolio Analyst from Interactive Brokers simplifies everything and lets you consolidate, track, and analyze all of your financial accounts in one place. Get a clear view of your portfolio's performance, asset allocation, and risk with powerful analytics. Use the Retirement Planner to set personalized goals, plan for the future, and track your progress. And you can stay on top of your spending with a budgeting tool. Best of all, Portfolio Analyst is completely free and gives you powerful insights to help you take control of your financial future. Set up your Portfolio Analyst account today, your free Portfolio Analyst account today, at ibkr.com/freePA. Interactive Brokers is a member SIPC.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Mental notes and market psychology. Clearing the noise to focus on the profit and what trends are really all about. And our guest today is Dr. Daniel Crosby, well-known behavioral finance expert. All this and much more on episode number 911 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, welcome to the Disciplined Investor Podcast. I'm Andrew Horowitz, and I got to tell you, I'm so excited, really, seriously excited about the lineup of guests that we have and that we've had. At the end of the year 2024, if you remember, I said that we are going to go deep, deep, and start off the year and bring you some great education. Here we are already into March, running right through that and bring you some really great information from guests that I think are top-notch. It's not always about the next great stock tip. It's not always about, you know, how can we beat the markets? Sometimes we need to spend a moment to stepping back and honing the blade. We need to sharpen our minds. And we can't always do that when we're in it. We're in the thick of it. When the markets are open and things are going and moving around. And that's if you're a trader. You know, if we're reading the news and all this stuff is coming at us fast and making decisions on the fly, if you're a short-term investor, or even sometimes as a buy and hold and a longer-term investor, it's not easy to see things if we're just staring at the same investments over and over. Sometimes we need to take a step back. We need to take a moment and look from afar. And also, I dare say, take a look inside. Take a look inside what we're thinking, how we're feeling, what we're doing, why it is that we're doing what we're doing, and going through the process of understanding ourselves and why we're choosing to react, invest, do what we're doing with respect to the information that we're getting. How can we take that moment and better ourselves? And that is what this week is all about. Today, again, with this week's guest. So let's just get right into it, shall we? And our guest today is Dr. Daniel Crosby. He's a psychologist, a New York Times bestselling author, and behavioral finance expert who helps organizations understand the intersection of mind and markets. His latest book, The Soul of Wealth, takes an in-depth look at the intersection of money and meaning. And when he's not decoding market psychology, Daniel is a father of three, a fanatical follower of the St. Louis Cardinals, explorer of the American South, and I think we touched on this before, an amateur hot sauce chef. So let's start there, my friend. How are you, first of all? Thanks for coming on again.
I'm great. Thank you for having me back.
So I got to talk about the hot sauce chef. My audience knows I'm an avid, you know, guy in the kitchen on everything. But what is your favorite particular peppers to be using in a particular sauce?
We go hard on the habanero and the serrano lately. That's kind of... That's kind of where we've been finding ourselves. And that's about, look, I'm not like a face melting hot sauce guy. That's about the limits of my heat tolerance. So yeah, Serrano and Habanero is kind of where I like to live.
I'd like to challenge you to go find Datil, D-A-T-I-L peppers. Have you had those?
I'm growing them.
You're growing Datil peppers? Seriously?
Yes. Yeah. I got a buddy from Florida who turned me on.
St. Augustine.
Yeah.
They're awesome.
They are awesome.
I think they're probably right in between the habanero and the serrano too, aren't they?
They are. I got a little grow operation in my bathroom. So I got some, I got a little light and everything right behind me. So yep, we're all set with those.
We got to do like a breaking hot.
That's right. Yeah, my job as a behavioral finance expert didn't pan out. So I started to create the world's purest hot sauce.
I love it. That's great. I do a lot of, and at this point, but I do like chili oils, things of that nature, kind of to have and to bottle up and just put away, and some other kinds of strange things like that that just goes along with. But that's awesome. One day I hope to try it. Well, let's talk about stuff and do a little refresher here. For those that don't know, for the greenies out there, the idea of behavioral finance and the intersection of our mind and money. I mean, first of all, let's mention that for a lot of people, money is top of mind, right? They can't get it off their mind.
Yeah, that's exactly right. In fact, you know, every year for about 40 something years, the American Psychological Association has run a top stressors in America survey. And this year, let's break down the top stressors in America. Number one is money. Number two is work. And number three is the economy. Yeah. So what do we got? Money, and money. Yeah. Effectively, money is effectively the top three stressors in the lives of our peers.
So when it comes to the idea then of the importance of money and how we actually respond to the influx of information regarding money that is surrounded in the study of behavioral finance. So tell us, what exactly is behavioral finance?
Yeah, behavioral finance is just this intersection of mind and markets. But, you know, why is this important? Well, in one of my past books, I looked at some research. It was fMRI research, so basically brain scan research that hooked people's brains up and exposed them to different stimuli and then measured the activation. So it was stuff like sex and death and politics and religion and, you know, all sort of the hot button topics. And of all of these, when they measure the excitatory power in the brain, money does more to excite the brain to generate emotion than any of those other hot button topics, which, you know, we consider sort of impolite and at a cocktail party to discuss. And so getting so emotional about our money can often lead us to make irrational decisions. And money, you know, has a unique power to throw us off our game and generate emotion.
Yeah, I mean, it's that's why people get addicted to things like gambling. I mean, it is a drug. Yeah. It is a drug. It is the that's the sensory overload that you get with some of this, right?
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. So let's go back. What inspired you? You know, behavioral finance hasn't been around. Well, it's been around forever, but not really, right? You know, the idea of how people react and all that probably has been studied, but it really wasn't, I think, put into this genre as tight as it is today into behavioral finance until more recently. You know, what inspired you to focus on this?
So I set out to be a shrink. My PhD is in clinical psychology, but about three quarters of the way through my doctoral program, I started to burn out on the work of being a psychotherapist. It's just very heavy. And so I came to my dad and asked for his advice. And my dad is a financial advisor. Now, this is whatever, 15 or 16 years ago. And, you know, I asked him, I said, hey, I want to study human behavior, but I don't want to do it in a medical setting. And he said, you should look into my world because there's a ton of psychology in the work that I do. And that was news to me. Now, my dad, who's a financial advisor in Alabama 15 years ago, did not know the words behavioral economics or behavioral finance. Mm-hmm. But he knew that a lot of his work as a fiduciary for his clients was managing their emotions, counseling them to make good decisions, and understanding the machinations of the emotional sides of the market. And so even though my dad didn't have the language to point me in exactly the right direction, that simple comment on his part led me to an exploration that got me to where I am today.
And one of the pioneers in really, I think, bringing this all together in the and into the forefront of, you know, it may have been out there, but like, oh yeah, that totally makes sense, right? I mean, as a credit to you, I think that is something to be said, because it was an underserved area, and we all knew there was herd behavior trending. You know, why does this happen? Why is it that this line on a chart may send a reaction? Because we all know that the others are, but nobody really said it. So good stuff. I mean, great stuff you did. Let me ask you this. This is going to be a loaded question. You have a lot of books out there, right?
Yeah.
Which is the favorite book that you wrote? Which one holds a special place in your heart?
Well, you know, you got to love The New Baby the most, perhaps. So, you know, The Soul of Wealth is my new book. This is one that's this intersection of money and meaning. When this country was founded, you know, 250-ish years ago, 85% of the world was living in poverty. Today, that number is 9%. So as a world, you know, capitalism has brought us this enormous bounty. The world is richer and more equal than it's ever been before. And yet we have this mental health crisis and this crisis of connection and loneliness and all of these sort of related concerns. So the new book is just all about money and meaning. Some of my previous work, the behavioral investor, if you're a hardcore dollars and cents quant type money manager, that's going to be more your style. But right now I'm loving this conversation around money and meaning and helping people take the wealth and the abundance they've created and spend, save it, invest it in ways that make them happy.
I think the funny thing is that this switch from 8% to, what do you say, 90%, the swap of people that were wealthy or not wealthy, but the world has gotten to a better place through capitalism, you said, right? Was that the numbers?
Uh-huh. That's right.
What's fascinating is the capitalism helped a large part of the world, even the socialists and the communists. True, yeah. Right? Seriously.
Yeah. It's raised all boats.
Raised
for sure.
All boats. But I think what you're hinting at also is it's created more misery.
Well, it's just created different problems, right? I mean, if you go back to your Psych 100 class and you think about that Maslow's hierarchy you learned back in your psych class, mm-hmm. you know, Gandhi said, paraphrasing, to a poor man, bread is God. You know, if you don't have money, all you're thinking about is your next meal. But now, as the world and especially the West has become increasingly wealthy, we're not worried about, you know, sleeping in a warm bed or having, you know, clean clothes to wear, having enough to eat. So our concerns kind of go upstream. Now we're worried about, you know, the meaning of life and friendship and connection and self-actualization. So the problems don't go away. They get a little higher class, but arguably a little more complicated as well.
There's so many things I want to talk to you about. And I think that it's really pertinent right now to talk about some of the things that are going on, because there are a lot of inputs that are happening and there are a lot of news flow that is coming out and in particularly at this time right now, right? I mean, at this moment in time. And I think there are these classic behaviors that we have as investors that are very, you know, we can get very charged politically from something. And right now with all this coming out so fast and furious, like trying to take a sip from an open water hydrant, right? The news flow is crazy. Mm-hmm. And we have these emotional responses that are triggered. And that can create some impulsive financial decisions. How do we as investors deal with that kind of situation?
Yeah, I'll talk about, I mean, I think you're sort of dancing around the political issue, which I think is one of the big ones we're up against right now. I was asked recently about sort of the mind of the investor. And I think just given where we are in the world today, there's two sort of primary psychological risks that beset many investors in 2025. The first would be recency bias. You know, so Andrew, our brains are, you know, small. They're like 2 to 3% of our body weight. but they're enormously hungry. They account for like 20 to 25% of our caloric expenditure in a given day. And so we're always looking for ways to sort of go into cruise control or autopilot with those brains. And one of the ways that we do that is we just assume that what has been recently is what always will be. And so for the average investor, if you look back at the last couple of years, we've been very good. We've had a 25% year, a 24% year in U.S. markets, which have averaged more like 10% a year historically. But people forget that, and they get benchmarked to that 24, 25% a year. So it feels to me like the average U.S. investor right now is expecting, you know, gaudy performance, is expecting the U.S. to be the only show in town, and is sort of expecting that just into the future indefinitely. And I think that's a form of hubris and a form of projection that could be a little bit dangerous. And we could get away from things like, diversification and prudent investing principles. The other one that's arguably even bigger is politically motivated investing. I shared a chart recently online that was just absolutely fascinating to me. And it was Democrats and Republicans' worries about inflation. And if you look back over the entirety of the Biden presidency, Democrats exhibited very low levels of worry about inflation. They just weren't all that troubled by it. And they sort of had an answer for why inflation was as high as it was. And they just weren't all that concerned about it. And now, once Trump got elected, suddenly Democrats' concerns for inflation is now through the roof. And you see the exact opposite, you know, on the other party. You know, Republicans have been screaming about inflation for the last 4 years, and now Trump gets elected, and now they show no concern for inflation whatsoever. Well, you know, we're getting recent evidence that inflation's still quite hot, and that it's no better. So you see this politically motivated reasoning all over the place. And to be clear, it's an everybody problem. It's not a left or right problem. It's an everybody problem.
Yeah.
And letting politics become your guiding force for when you choose to participate in markets or not, or how you choose to participate in markets, is so damaging. We looked at research recently that showed that when people's non-preferred candidate was in power, they tended to underperform dramatically those whose preferred candidate was in power, because they took less risk, they were more tentative, they jumped in and out of the market more. So people have to be really aware of this tendency to not let their political biases taint the way they invest.
You know, let's get back to the recency bias situation that you talked about, 24 or 25% 2 years in a row. Investors get used to that. They think that's the only play and that's the one that's going to win. That's why Kansas City, by the way, was favored in the Super Bowl, because of the exact same thing. Just follow the markets, right? The last 2 years. Mm-hmm. And we have the three-peat. The question is going to be, do we have a three-peat in the markets in 2025? And I'm not saying we should take the Kansas City under over on that, right? But exactly what you're saying, encapsulated in real time, why people were looking at that. Now, there's the other side of it, which we could talk about, which was another type of investing and a behavioral-based investing, which is contrarianism, if you will, right? Mm-hmm. Well, you know what? They won. They shouldn't win. I don't want them to win. Why? Because at Kansas City, they won the last 2 years. You know, let's go for the underdog. So talk about the contrarian side of investing and that behavior.
Yeah, so there's a very simple form of contrarianism. If you talk about, you know, globally diversified investing, if you look back over, say, 45 years beginning in 1970, and you look, I'm not suggesting this allocation, this is just an example. If you did a third U.S., a third emerging, and a third, you know, developed non-U.S. markets, the best market over that time got 10.5%. The worst got about 9.4%. But if you equal weighted those, let them run for a year, and then rebalance them back to where they started, back to a third, a third, a third at the beginning of every year, you got 10.8% returns, even though the best market, which was Europe, got 10.5%, US got 10.4%. this is a form of contrarianism. Just there's simple ways to be a contrarian. I mean, just simply like rebalancing every year back to your original allocation has the effect of sort of buying low and selling high. So yeah, contrarianism, sometimes we feel like we have to take this big, this big sort of contrary position or this big dramatic stake. Sometimes it can be simple and effective and very, very humble.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So going back to where we are and talking about these classic behaviors that happen and really looking at the most recent situation, one of the things also when it comes to the politics is something that, you know, I didn't really hear about this until a few years ago. I think it was, if I remember correctly, it may have been you, and it was also like Barry Ritholtz. They were just using this over and over and over. It was like the new toy word that was being used, and it was confirmation bias. And it was this thing that was being like this aha moment. It seemed like that to me, at least. This aha moment that, you know, we sometimes are waiting for, well, you describe it. I'm not going to describe it. You describe confirmation bias.
Yeah, so confirmation bias is our tendency to seek out information that confirms our pre-existing opinions. So they've, again, politics is the easy place to talk about this. You know, if people who have a given political preference, whether it be left or right, if you show them two articles, you know, one that's sort of critiquing their position and one that's affirming their position, they spend about 65% longer reading and absorbing the article of the information that supports their pre-existing values. We also have what's called the backfire effect, which is sort of a reaction, another form of confirmation bias. If people have a value, right, they believe the market's going to do X, or they believe President Trump is good or bad. If you present them with information that speaks against that value, right? If you present them with facts and figures that speak against their emotional value, well, not only do they not believe you, they actually double down on their beliefs and become more entrenched. And so you see people, you know, on Facebook or Twitter trying to fight about politics or religion or whatever it may be, and everybody's just further digging in. And, you know, it's no surprise that in the age of social media, people have not become more centrist. They've become more polarized because everyone's screaming and everyone's retreating further and further into their ideological camps.
I mean, this is the whole discussion of I'm a liberal and I watch CNN all the time. I'm a conservative. Right. I watch Fox all the time and try to explain those hardcore right left to say, you know what, why don't you just for a moment just take a half hour out of your 4-hour stint on either side and just listen to the other guy, see what's going on. Oh, no, that's crap. You know?
Yeah, I'm not going to reveal my particular political preferences on the show. But when I try and watch, you know, we'll call it the other guy's network, it's difficult. Like it really is when you're watching sort of your non-preferred news source. It's really hard.
Yeah,
it hurts.
I mean, I tend to be honest with you, I tend to stay away from any of the sides. Like if it's left or right, I'm like, I'm really not interested. I really just can't deal with it. I just want the facts. Let me figure it out, and they'll go from there. That's me. I mean, I'm a much more like a Reuters, Bloomberg. Well, it's money stuff, right? You know, just give me the raw numbers. You know, I just want to see it and let me figure it out from there. But I want to talk about, this trend following. You know, as a matter of fact, in the social sentiment, I had Howard Lindzen. You know Howard, right?
I do.
Yeah, I had Howard on a couple of weeks ago, and we talked about obviously the social sentiment that was brought upon, basically utilizing stock twits and the, I guess the common or the level of interest that is shown on the platform for a particular stock and how the social sentiment can go up and down. And that's used by a lot of other places to like maybe create algorithms to invest, to be honest with you, from a trading trend following area. And what we just talked about was this, oh, I'm a Fox guy, I'm a CNN guy, whatever, you know, pick whatever side. And I'm going to align myself with, I'm only going to wear red ties because everybody in the room's wearing red tie, right? So you have the same thing in investing, where it's like, okay, let's see. Well, I think everybody's buying NVIDIA. Let me look around. Yeah, everybody's buying NVIDIA. I'm going along with the two. And you have this classic herding behavior that goes on. And people feel, I think, maybe more comfortable. It's like a warm blanket that surrounds them. And they feel that if everybody else is doing it, I'm going to do it too. And I'm going to get in it. And we're going to all do it. And then you have also that comfortable feeling of, which I never really understood this one. You know what? Everybody's down. I'm down. Everybody's down. It's okay. Right? You know what I'm saying? Where it's like, if everybody is in the same boat, like, oh my God, the market's down 20%. I'm down 25%. And I'm probably no worse than anybody else. I'm okay with the fact that I'm down. But if most of the market is up and you're down, you're gonna commit Harry Carey. Right? So you have herding behavior, and then we have comparative behavior. So let's start with herding behavior and talk about that a little bit on how that kind of affects markets.
Yeah. So, I mean, both of these are sort of underpinned by a single behavioral tendency, which is that, you know, the ability, humankind's greatest gift is the ability to work together. You know, when you look at other animals, you know, we're an animal, you look at other animals, we're not fast, we're not strong, we don't have sharp teeth or fur, you know, we don't have any of the things that make other animals sort of, you know, be what they are. The thing that we do well is that we work together and allows us to build governments and civilizations and churches and, you know, all of that. And so that's good and bad because, you know, it causes us to herd. And look, even some herding investing, things like momentum investing, have a strong empirical basis. They can work very well until they don't. So, you know, in some ways, being part of the herd isn't always a bad thing if you can sort of figure out when the music stops. But then the same thing is true on the other end. We've got this comparative misery or comparative underperformance because we don't work in absolutes. We work in relatives. And, you know, I talk in my new book about how comparison is the thief of joy. And even when you look at people's financial wellness and how financially contented they are, there's two predictors of that. Two things are predictive of financial wellness, and they're equally predictive. One is, of course, how much money you have, which is, of course, material. But the second predictor, which is just as powerful, is who are you comparing yourself to? You know, are you comparing yourself to people who are far richer than you? Or are you picking a more even playing field? So this is something we're very prone to. It's never going away. It's hardwired for us to be benchmarking to our peers.
Isn't this the peacock feather discussion? Isn't it the, you know, oh, that Mr. Peacock, Mr. Daniel Peacock and Mr. Andrew Peacock, you know, you're walking around strutting around with your peacock feathers out, right? And I'm walking around going, oh my God, look at how big his are. You know, and I may be a lot younger, a lot something different or whatever, but it creates misery. And then the comparative, I mean, I can't think of anything worse than social media for the comparative game, right? You know, wow, look at that. Man, look how blue that guy's eyes are. And look at that ocean. Well, did anybody think that they used some kind of colorizing system on it? Or, man, look at all that. Look at he goes out to eat. He does all this stuff. Really? Maybe just put all this stuff on there at one day and it looks great. Nobody's going, look, Daniel, let me ask you, you use social media here and there, or you have in the past, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. You ever put down in social media what a miserable day you had that, you know, you know, with my kids are biggest pain in the ass today. I can't stand each one of them. My wife, I got to be honest, she got up. She looked ugly as hell. You never posted any of those things, did you?
Well, to be clear, Andrew, my wife is always beautiful. I hope she's listening. Yeah.
Of course.
To your point, though, you've got everyone posting the highlight reels of their lives, and then we're there knowing every zit, every bump in the road and comparing our minute to minute to other people's highlight reels. The other thing that makes this sort of a formula for financial misery is, you know, for most of human history, you lived and knew like 100, 150 people. And they were probably pretty similar to you with respect to, you know, financial, socioeconomic status and things like that. And so your comparison was somewhat limited. But now, you know, we can compare our eyes to the bluest eyes in the world. And we can compare our bankroll to the biggest bankroll in the world and our abs to the best abs in the world. And, you know, we can find ourselves wanting in many areas if we're not thoughtful about what we call reference classes.
Yeah. I'm the reference class for all those, by the way.
I love it.
Yeah. Hey, listen, I want to talk about some the big four behavioral errors and things about what investors are thinking about today and get more into the conversation of your book, The Soul of Wealth. Hang on, we're going to be right back. We're going to kind of take a quick break. And I want to talk about interactive brokers because I don't want you to be fooled by zero commissions on crypto trades because some brokers add a spread to the price you pay. But at interactive brokers, there are no hidden spreads and you pay much less than you would at places like Gemini and Robinhood or even Fidelity. Keep more in your pocket and trade crypto for less coin at interactive brokers. Trading cryptocurrencies involves risk and is only for individuals with a high risk tolerance and the financial ability to sustain losses. Compare other brokers' fees and see how much you can save at ibkr.com/crypto. And we're back with Dr. Daniel Crosby. By the way, Daniel Crosby is also the chief, the head, the big wig of psychology, behavioral finance at Orion as well. And I think also a big named hoo-ha at Brinker, right? Am I right about this?
Well, Orion bought Brinker, so now just Orion. Yeah. But yes.
Okay, right. But you head up the whole behavioral finance component for Orion, which is a major company that deals with wealth management, with also systems and programs that like I use, for example, for clients. So good for you, man. Good for you.
It's a great gig.
Let me talk to me about the big four. The big four, which, by the way, used to be the big eight. If you know anything about accounting, does that make it? Is that a funny? Is that a stupid joke? You didn't get it?
I got it.
Okay, good. For those of you who don't, there used to be the big eight, then the big six, now the big four in accounting firms. So you got the big four behavioral errors. Talk to me about that.
Yeah. So some of my work has been around sort of simplifying and streamlining the ever-growing list of cognitive errors. So we've got these very long lists. There's like 200 different ways you can screw up your financial life now. But some of my research has been around what are the big ones that sort of underpin all the others? And there's four. So the first of these is ego. So this is basically the various flavors of overconfidence, thinking that we know more about the future than we do, thinking that we're luckier than we are, thinking that we're better than we are. And again, like all of these things serve us well in other contexts, you know, thinking that we are better looking, smarter, better drivers than average. It leads us to do things like be happy when we get up in the morning. And that's a good thing. It leads us to go, you know, talk to the good looking person at the bar who we maybe have no business talking to, but then we end up hitting it off. So, I mean, there's many ways where this serves us. But when we bring it to the world of money, it starts to hurt. So ego, these various flavors of overconfidence is the first one. The second is emotion. This is confusing the head and the heart, you know, the numbers and the gut. And so a lot of times, I mean, emotion is just a much, much more powerful driver than crunching the numbers. So we tend to rely on what our gut says over what the numbers say. And of course, that can get us in trouble. The third thing is attention, which is confusing things that are loud with things that are likely. Mm. You know, we think about what spooks markets, and a lot of times it's things like, you know, bird flu or a terrorist act or all these things that are all over the news, but the true risk of which tends to be rather small. And so a lot of times it becomes critical for us to think about our media diet and the things that we're putting in our mind and the things that we're exposing ourselves to so that we're not living in fear from these sort of overblown risks that are the bread and butter of news and financial news. And then the last one is conservatism, which is the sort of the various flavors of being risk averse.
Risk averse,
loss averse, status quo prone. In general, we like what we like. We like the things we know. We like to play it safe. We don't like to gamble. And this can bite us in markets who, you know, in a very real sense, pay you well for uncertainty. Hmm.
So all that goes on all the time, right? Mm. The The ego thing, the great thing you mentioned about, I actually was in a, what was I? I think it was, I recall I was at Covey Institute. You know, remember Stephen Covey, Seven Habits of Highly Effective People. I was in Pecos River, New Mexico. There was a retreat. There was all sorts of ropes courses and classes. This is years ago. And I think there was a question that was asked in that session, something like, raise your hand if you think you're an above average driver. There's like 25 of us in a room. And you know what happened, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Everybody, you know, 80% of the people raised their hands. And they said, well, this is not exact count here, but how is that possible? Right? It should be only 50% above average, right? Or 49%, you know, or whatever you want to say, right? So out of the people, maybe 13 people would raise their hand at above average. Now, again, it wasn't an exact point, but overconfidence, which is your ego discussion, which is exactly, I don't know if it's radically 180 degrees from conservatism, because that's a little bit different, right? But still, it creates some things where if you add that to things like recency bias, you got problems.
Yeah, no, you're exactly right. And there's actually sort of three different forms of overconfidence, but you've talked about, I think, the best known one, which is thinking that we're better than other people. I cited research. It was a survey of 700 men. 94% of the men thought they were better looking than average. 95% of the men thought that they had a better than average sense of humor. And 100% of the men thought that they were friendlier than average. I mean, it's just shocking. Like, we just really don't know how to gauge, gauge our skill on a relative level. And it leads us to do stuff like overtrade. It leads us to do stuff like, try and time the market and, jump in and out, not rely on an advisor, try and go it alone. I mean, it leads to all kinds of bad places, especially when you pair it with some of the others, like you said.
Yeah. And then that's an interesting point, though. You know, if I make all these mistakes and nobody sees it, but me, are they really mistakes? You know, if a bear, craps in the wood or nobody sees it, does it really happen, or a tree falls, whatever you want to call it. But the point is that, some people are embarrassed, right? That the ego needs to stay intact to maintain their sense of self.
Well, it's funny that you mentioned that, that if no one hears the tree fall in the woods thing, because I also looked at people's recollection of their trading behavior. So DIY investors, and they have effectively zero recollection of their worst trades and then like excellent recollection of their best trades. So even our memory conspires to sort of perpetuate this overconfidence where we, we talk at the cocktail party about the thing we did well, and we sort of forget all the times we lost money. So it a lot of your body is conspiring, your body and your mind is conspiring to make you think you're better than you are, because it makes you happy, but it doesn't bode well for maximizing your returns.
No, it's reactionary protectionism, right? So it's like, getting near something hot, you just stay away, right? I don't need to go and think about things that are harmful to my my mind is making it so I don't need to think about those things. So therefore, I don't. But when it comes to, in the soul of wealth, you have research. That a lot of people are unhappy in retirement, even, by the way, if they have enough assets, right? They're doing fine. What's with that? Because I know some people, by the way, let me just say this one other point, that is like, okay, so I'm a bit opposite of this. The idea of this thing out in the future, this retirement thing, right, which I'm not sure exactly what that means. And just to give you just a quick story of me that you don't know probably, when I was very young, like 21, I decided to move to Florida. I was in New York, and there's a couple of different reasons. It had to do a little bit with the snow and all, but there's also this thought that, let me get this straight. All these people, my grandparents and all these wealthy people that I know and all these other, they moved to Florida to retire, to live the life. This is what I know, right? This is all I knew. They go to Florida. What the hell am I waiting for? Why can't I do that now? Not retire necessarily, but why can't I move there, enjoy whatever the heck is going on, and just be there? And I found a place that I love. I mean, I just love it down here, right? And there's negatives, but generally speaking, I just absolutely adore this place, the weather, the things to do, the everything about it, the people. But there's other people I know that have this. And I also don't know about ever retiring because I feel like I just love what I do in life from a work standpoint and a play standpoint. It just all works together for me. But there are people that are like, okay, well, I'm either forced to retire or I have this idea that I'm going to retire. And that's when I'm going to do something and I'm going to be happy. And they kind of work all their days, miserable as can be, and then eventually retire. And then they retire and they're still not happy. What gives?
Yeah, it's that person that I want to speak to and sort of share some of this research. So there's research from Dr. Martin Seligman that talks about basically the formula for a happy life. So we're giving you gems here on the show today. So there's basically five things you need to live a life of flourishing, a life of joy. The first one of them is what he calls positive experiences. This is just fun and leisure. This is, you know, going out on a boat, going to a baseball game, eating an ice cream cone, you know, whatever relaxing, fun, leisure activities are. That's one thing. Now, when people think about retirement, this is the primary thing that they lock in on. Like, retirement's going to be so fun. I'm going to golf. I'm going to boat. I'm going to play tennis. I'm going to go to a movie midday, you know, whatever it is. No one's going to be able to tell me what to do. And that is indeed part of what makes us happy. But if you look at the other four things, the second thing is engagement. This is deep, meaningful work. The third is relationships. The fourth is meaning, working for something bigger than yourself or being part of a team. Mm-hmm. And then the final one is advancement, which is growing, learning, achieving, kind of climbing that mountain every day. If you think about these five things, work does four of them very well because, you know, work helps us advance. It gives us something larger than ourselves to work on. Mm-hmm. It puts us with other people. It's a source of deep work and engagement. Like, work, if you think about the five things that make life worth living, work does four of them well and one of them poorly. Only sort of this relaxing, fun and leisure thing does work really not scratch that itch. People plan their retirement almost, you know, in diametric opposition to that, where they go, they over-index on the fun to the exclusion of the work, the growth, and the connection. Then they arrive at retirement, and then within 2 weeks, they're sick of golf and tennis, and they miss their friends, they miss using their mind, they miss growing. And so people have to plan for growth. They have to plan for connection, and they have to plan for advancement and work. You know, now the work may be learning a hobby. It may be learning to play guitar or woodworking or a million things. It doesn't have to be, you know, financially compensated work. But the idea that we can just have fun for 30 years is sort of divorced from the science of what makes us happy.
And the nice thing is, the old days, when I first started in this business, my planning went something like this. You're going to live till, you're going to work till you're 65. And then we have enough money for 10 years to retire on, and then you're going to die. That was kind of the plan, right? Something like that. Yeah. People didn't live as long. We know that. That's just a fact. I mean, we've seen an incredible increase in longevity, and that's been, I don't know, that's been last 50 years or so definitely different than it was, right? So people living to 85, 90, and people are working till 75 or whatever, or just continually working. And it's a whole different way. And maybe that's part of the solution. Maybe that's part of the five. Maybe there's more to do with not only happiness, but also maybe you're living longer. I mean, I got to believe that you believe that too.
Yeah. Yeah. That's definitely the case. And I mean, look, longevity is increasing dramatically. And I think we're seeing, I mean, the world just keeps accelerating. The pace of innovation, the pace of change just keeps accelerating. That's happening in medicine too. And I think that AI and other technologies are going to bring us crazy breakthroughs, and we're going to have to start planning. I mean, I have an 8-year-old, and when my 8-year-old was born, the doctor told us, look, she's got about a 35-40% chance of living to be 100. Wow. And, you know, we're going to have to start planning for longer and longer lifespans. People are going to need to work longer, And they're going to need to find the Andrew Horowitz formula where they can find, you know, where they can find this integration of work and life and work that isn't soul sucking, right? Because you're going to need to do it for a very long time.
Yeah, I mean, that's not the easiest thing to do. But yeah, I agree. And all seriousness, I think you have a really good point. You got to find something you're happy with. And that doesn't mean that necessarily what you're unhappy with can't be changed either. Right. You can't adapt. You can't change your mind because there is something to be said about, you know, not, you don't always have to change the job. You could change yourself a little bit too, right?
For sure. You know, yeah, it's a lot easier than changing the job.
A lot easier changing yourself than changing others, at least in my experience. Dr. Daniel Crosby. First of all, I want to tell everybody very quickly, you could find out more information about Dr. Crosby over on The Disciplined Investor. Just look up the show notes for this episode. And also, I want to make sure very clearly, go buy his book or books. How about books? Books. Now, there's one book that's actually free on Kindle that I looked up. It's one of your first ones. It's something about me, something about you.
You're not that great?
You're not that great. I think it's free on Kindle. Or there's at least a promotion or something going on Kindle.
Yeah, I think it is.
You're not that great. I mean, if that doesn't piss you off to begin with, I don't know what will with the title. But definitely go buy his book, The Soul of Wealth. Thanks, Daniel Crosby. Dr. Daniel Crosby. Great, great insights today. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure, Andrew. Thank you.
Thanks. And thanks for joining me for another action-packed discussion on the Disciplined Investor Podcast. I think that was a great learning experience with respect to how we understand ourselves, how we understand markets, how others understand markets, and then how we can, I guess, glean some thoughts about what others are doing and understand why the trend is what it is. Does that make sense? I hope so. We have a lot more lined up over the next few weeks. I hope you keep on joining us and making sure to spread the word. Listen on YouTube, Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, Spotify, anywhere that you get your fine podcasts, and even the lousy ones. We're probably on those lists too. on the list, hopefully at the top of those lists. But nonetheless, wherever you get your fine and great podcasts, that's where we're at as well. Thank you for joining me this week and every week. I'll see you again real soon. Nothing discussed in this podcast should be considered a recommendation to buy or sell any security. Past performance is no indication of future results. In addition, the information presented is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should be construed as advice designed to meet the individual needs of any particular investor. Nothing herein constitutes legal, accounting, or tax advice, or individually tailored investment advice. Remember, investing involves substantial risk. Past performance is not a guarantee of future results, and a loss of original capital may occur. No one receiving or accessing this information should make any investment decision without first consulting his or her own personal financial advisor and conducting his or her own research and due diligence, including carefully reviewing any applicable prospectuses, press releases, reports, and other public filings of the issuer of any securities being considered. Please consider this for educational purposes only. As always, use your best judgment when investing. Horowitz & Company, Inc. is registered as an investment advisor with the state of Florida and conducts business in other states where it is properly registered or is excluded from registration requirements. Registration does not imply any level of skill or training. Advertisements are not related to the host or affiliates and are not considered recommendations by the host of the show or any affiliates of Horowitz & Company.